willing to be taped. Also, I, as I was working late last night, I called Don Wright, who over in the years past we have parted ways politically, but we always have been able to talk and get along with him. But he's agreed to come and talk. And he is, if you've read this book, you'll know that he was a very key figure in trying to get the settlement put together. And you know, the interesting thing about this the Settlement Act is that, you know, one wonders whether or not it would have been possible to have secured a settlement if there had not been a substantial disintegration of our cultures. You understand what I mean? I mean, you know, most of our grandparents or parents were they were too respectful of people to put up the kind of fight that we had to put up in order to in other words, we had to understand the political tactics of dealing with the Western world in order to do the things that we did. You know, we were not afraid to say no, right, which is something that our people don't like to do. It's not a part of their makeup, but, you know, to put people in a position to say no. It's bad manners, you know. And that's sort of a traditional way of communicating. We don't, the society was made up so that conflicts were generally nipped in the bud before they became conflicts because of the closeness of the society and the fact that you had to cooperate, you know, to survive. And quite often if there was a problem within a family, you know, certain relatives would get into it so that two people who should get along wouldn't have to deal with that issue, right, or that problem. If one of them was causing problems, maybe an uncle or, you know, somebody else would take care of the problem. So in a way, for people who are unhappy about the nature of the settlement that that came, or that that we got through Congress, I think there has to be some understanding of where we were by the time 1971 came along. And while we've already gotten to some of the substance of the act, I thought I'd talk a little bit about some of the circumstances in which we operated and circumstances that had preceded us. And are any of you in my Tuesday class? Just one of you. You've heard this all before. Well, but in any case, what I tried to do last week was try to bring out some of the issues, or at least show you some of the issues that were on our minds during the process of promoting this the idea of a land settlement or a land claim. And as you notice, we virtually didn't discuss any aspect of the mechanism, right? I mean, nobody asked, you know, well, how are we going to run this thing, right? What's the mechanism going to be of a settlement? That wasn't really discussed that much. You know, there was concern over the PHS, about the DIA, you know, and how how this money was going to be spent. And very little discussion about the actual mechanism. And we also, I think that film showed something about the financial the financial limitations that we functioned under. We just absolutely didn't have anything to work with.
When we started trying to get something done about preserving the land, let me tell you how bad it was. I mean, when I was on campus here, that spring of 66, after I had done that paper, which I should have brought down, but I'm having Gary Anders reproduce this paper I wrote in 66 that sort of revealed, at least to me, what appeared to be the situation. That is, because of all that had transpired legally and politically, the revelation was, when you broke it all down, we never had given up our right to the land. And so that was a great revelation to me. I understood, you know, from that point on, that that unless we did something, we were a bit ultimately going to lose it all. And in order to get started, I had to get back to Kotzebue. Well, I couldn't even afford to get back to Kotzebue. So I had to borrow money to get back to Kotzebue. But even before that, I had to borrow $10 just to mail my letters to the villages, to the 11 villages around Kotzebue. I wrote about a 4-page letter sort of describing what I understood to be the situation, that we had to do something to protect the land because ultimately the state may select it or other parties might select it under the public land laws. Because we hadn't filed it. So I borrowed $10 from Harriet Bunny just to mail those letters. And of course, we didn't have any newsletters either. No. The Tundra Times was functioning at the time. But, you know, the circulation wasn't all that substantial. And at that time, well, a lot of people, you know, even though you wrote about it, like, these letters that I wrote, they stuck up on the store wall, right? And for somebody to kind of stand there, people didn't quite understand what I was saying, because, of course, in order to be galvanized into action, you know, there generally has to be a threat of some type, right? You know, to something that at least you perceive as a threat. Well, we couldn't see that. I mean, you know, when you're looking from a village, you know, you couldn't see it unless you had, say, been living in, say, the interior, like Tanacross or, you know, Chief Isaac's people. You know, I mean, they knew that they were being descended upon, and they didn't have that piece of paper that says, this is ours. Well, up in our villages, you know, everybody was just kind of buzzing around and using the land just like before. And so my 4-page or 5-page letter, you know, I was trying to be Patrick Henry or somebody, whoever it was that, you know, saying the British are coming, the Americans were coming, but didn't make any sense to them, right? And so there had to be a bit more work done to try to show that there was a threat. And of course, that was the perception problem on the side of our people living in the villages who had not had access to, you know, reading, right, and history, and the law, the American law, and had not had exposure to the American Indians. And their trials and tribulations over, you know, up to 300 years. So you can imagine how difficult that was for some 24-year-old guy, or, you know, and it was that way in a lot of different places around the state, where we were going around trying to say, the British are coming, but it's just like the guy crying wolf, you know. I mean, where is the wolf, right? And so it was rather difficult to convey the sense of urgency when there was no apparent threat. and because the land had been utilized for some umpteen thousands of years, and there was nobody trying to say, don't use it. I mean, we had, by that time, the creeping controls of Fish and Wildlife Service and Fish and Game were sort of kind of like on Little Cat's feet, you know, informed about the fog. Well, it was creeping up on us, and but it wasn't really drastic, right? So when it comes to, that is the seasons, you know, of when you can catch something or where you couldn't. Well, you see, I mean, if our people had been able to foresee that that 25-cent subsistence ticket or whatever it was, license that they used to have to pay for, if they could have foreseen what that would have meant. But see, we had no organizations, we had no lawyers, right? We had no anything who understood anything about the law and about history. So, in effect, what independence we had of being who we were or are, you know, was sort of, it didn't occur all of a sudden. I think it started a long time ago. And people dutifully paid for this right, right? I mean, it was a symbol, you know, of the federal government's authority, their perceived authority to mandate that these people were basically under control. And so, you know, when you think about the whale problem, hell, it started way down here with muskrats, right? And, you know, and everything else. So, in effect, you know, the changing of the way our peoples utilize the resources, which were a part of their whole identity, began a long time ago. I mean, long before 1971. So we could not, I mean, this, you know, the threat to the land was one thing. I mean, you know, the threats to our ability to continue utilizing these various species of fish and game for our survival, you know, was an element, right? The whole land thing was just the maximum, right, in terms of anything physical. That is, being an Athabascan or being an Eskimo was wrapped up in what you did. Your hunting and fishing, that was part of your way. Of course, and all that activity that went on the land and on the rivers and lakes, you know, was part of who you were, or who you are, but couldn't be seen that easily. And this four-page letter that I wrote, well, some people read and they thought it was kind of interesting, but it didn't exactly galvanize anybody into action saying, yeah, let's do it. So I had to go the step further. Like, if I had had my druthers, you know, I would have much rather have been able to say, here's the problem. Like, here's what I see as the problem. And then have a whole army of people say, agree, yes, it is the problem, and go do it. No, I mean, I had to physically go up there, you know, and on borrowed funds, and decided to run for the legislature. Well, that, I thought, well, I don't expect to win. At least I will have a chance to talk to people and say, I think there's a threat out there. If we don't do something, we may just lose it. And lo and behold, I won. So at least that gave me some freedom, you know, to expound on what I considered a public issue, this land issue. But the financial limitations on our ability to organize were severe. This was our group was just one example of almost a complete lack of financial resources to do anything. And
when we called for meetings, when I called for meetings,
you know, I was frankly kind of amazed that some villages actually sent people down. Because here I had been out of the area since I was 14. I'd been gone for 10 years. And normally anybody who's gone for 10 years has got to have been all screwed up by then, right? And you don't know who he is anymore. And but they did show up. Some came by boat, and we had, I forget how many, I haven't gone back to check the record to see how many times we met, but about on our third meeting or so is when I finally got them, at least a half a dozen of them, to make the filing on that 11 village area, which is in effect was the initial start of what was called a land freeze. but it was initially an administrative order by Secretary Udall as these claims started piling up. You know, we had to stop the disposition of the land to bring it to protect ourselves. That was just the initial knee-jerk reaction on our part was to stop the disposition of land, the selection of land by the state or any other third party. Well, that was the reason for going and claiming this land. And of course the state or the BLM prefer to call them protests because they were claiming that these were protests against state selection, which was a mechanism provided for in the Statehood Act that allowed people to protest if they had some valid claim. So as these piled up, of course, the BLM was sort of hobbled by it. And frankly, we didn't receive a hell of a lot of help from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. You know, now they may have done some good in the interior here in some instances, but those of us out there in the various agencies, like the Bethel Agency or the or the Nome Agency, they're a little bit teed off that we would dare do, their natives would dare do anything without their consent and knowledge, right? So they never really gave us a hand. And that, I think, was one aspect that had a little bit to do with the ultimate outcome. Because from then on, because as time went on, the knowledge about the situation far outstripped those in the bureaucracy. Right? As those of us who were working on the thing, understood the limitations of working with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And of course, under the traditional Indian settlements, the Bureau of Indian Affairs had a very, very heavy hand in the decision-making by the tribe because this was trust land, trust property, you know, lots of Bureau responsibility. And consequently, this led to a disinclination to have anything at all to do with our settlement by BIA itself. In the ultimate settlement, there was virtually no responsibility for the Bureau, very minimal one, in the enrollment area. and the other aspect of that, those early days was that we had a complete lack of information. I mean, I think you understand that even though that Allotment Act had been on the books since 1906, that there were a very, very minimal number of allotments that had actually been issued to Native people, which would have been some protection for them. So you can imagine, I had to go find my own, you know, in that little paper I did. And that little paper that I did was distributed in October of 1966 when we founded the AFN. And that was about all most of our people had was my little paper that said, well, Willie says that we own it, right? And because we just didn't have anything. And so we had to start from a complete an almost total ignorance about what rights, if any, we had. And we had to develop it as we went along. And we had to try to learn it as we went along. I spent a good bit of my time in those days just like I do now, mouthing off, you know, trying to get people to see that, these are the ways that the federal government have done in the past. These are the ways that they have provided for Native people to secure land. This is what we have to do if we're going to try to save some of them. And this is what's happened before, that sort of thing. And and of course, on top of that, we had a linguistic, kind of a linguistic gap. I'd been gone too much. I wasn't fluent in Inupiaq anymore. And so we had to get people to understand it, those who were living in the villages, to understand what the heck we were talking about. And so it was a wonder that they allowed us to move, you know, as we did move. They sort of permitted us to go ahead and take these actions. In our area, the first thing that we did was after we finally got the filing made and sent into the BLM, you know, we formed a NANA. And of course, since nobody was there to help us, in order to have some semblance of an organization, we had to form a nonprofit organization on a regional basis, because the BIA only wanted to recognize the village. And this was kind of a sort of a prevalent attitude on the part of the state as well as the BIA, because they did not want to deal with any entities that had any power. The BIA preferred to think in terms of village entities, and that was sort of their perspective, in part because of the Indian Reorganization Act. You know, because what they'd done is they'd gone in and tried to civilize the people and teach them about democratic forms, and they formed the IRA. These are federally chartered tribal corporations, in effect. That was the perspective the BIA was coming in on, from a village by village basis. But of course, we needed strength. You know, we needed whole groups, because there was no way that, you know, we could get each village to respond. It cost too much, and we didn't have the resources. So we had to do the next best thing, which was to form the regional organizations. But since nobody, we didn't know about the process of this IRA, whether they'd even recognize us, the next best thing was to form a regular nonprofit corporation for education and cultural purposes. But of course, its main objective in reality was political. That's when we first formed our Northwest Alaska Native Association, ultimately becoming our regional name. This forming the region was, and the way we worked it in terms of its representative capacity was we allowed every community to select its own board members. And it was indirect representation in a sense, but it was the best we could do. You know, we'd have either the village council select whomever they felt could do the job to send to our meetings. And that's how we operated. Of course, the first thing we did was just to show you that everything was political. The first thing we did was, of course, we endorsed Gravel, Egan, and Hensley. It was in the Nome Nugget, I remember. Everybody said, well, where did this group come from? Well, it was election year. See, we had to start, and you'll find now, as it was then, that we have to use everything, you know, everything at all to survive, right? So, and we started using the political process because that was an avenue, that was about the only real avenue at that time to do anything, was to use the political process. And that's, I think, one notable fact about the situation up here, in contrast to the lower state tribes who in fact sort of ignored the system, right? Ignored the American system, because they felt that if they got enmeshed in it, that it would somehow destroy them, right? And their ability to maintain their own identity, their own land. So many of them were just kept hands off and just engaged in tribal politics. Nothing to do with the state. They wouldn't, many of them wouldn't vote in national elections or anything, even though they had the right. But up here, we went right into the political system and used it just like every other people would, any other American. And so I was running for the House and the State House, and he was running for governor, and he lost, didn't he? He lost to Hickel by 1,200 votes or something. And of course, Gravel as well lost. That's when he was running against Ralph Rivers for the primary. And Ralph Rivers beat him. That's when Howard Pollack got elected, 1966. Ancient history now. But the other thing is, of course, we didn't have any experienced people. Experienced leaders, I guess, maybe.
We didn't have anybody who had been there before.
And we had had some local politicians, like in our area, we had two or three or four former legislators. But, well, at this particular time, we had to have a new breed, because it was something that was a lot different than what they'd been dealing with before. And some of the ones we had before, unfortunately, they just maybe had a fifth grade education with little real exposure, you know, to the Western way of doing things. And and so we had to start from absolute scratch in terms of leadership. In some places, it varied from place to place, but in most of the regions, except for Southeast, where they had had umpteen years of political activity through the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood, they had a lot of experienced leadership, and they had rather stable old leadership. In fact, most of the leadership I had seen on a national level at the National Congress of American Indians were older Tlingit leaders. They were kind of accustomed to being involved in representation, in the representation capacity in their regions, in their region, and on a national level. But up north here, there had been a very minimal amount of exposure of that type. So I suppose, in a way, we sort of had to have people who were not tied into the system, in a sense. Because, you know, if you're enmeshed in the system, then your maneuverability is minimized, right? I mean, you have somebody lording it over you, and you may not get that promotion, or, you know, your job prohibits you from. So a lot of us were unemployed. I mean, I was actually employed by the legislature. But that the only reason I had any maneuverability was because I earned $500 a month, right, from the legislature when I was getting started. So I had a way to stay alive. Some of the others it was tough, you know, because many of them had their own jobs as well as trying to do this other thing, and it led to all kinds of family problems and stuff for a lot of the leadership. So, in a way, that, you know, when we formed NANA, let me tell you, we had to kind of scrounge around for at least a dozen people that might stick in their neck out, because our people were so unaccustomed to taking on the system. And you know, if we were going to stop the disposition of land to anybody, man, we were going to go for the jugular, right? We were going to stop it. And trying to find 12 guys who would take the heat, and I knew, basically, instinctively, that there were going to be some real problems. And because we were going to be making some decisions, you know, political decisions on candidates, decisions on the land, and we were going to be beating on the politicians who had all that power. And so we found a few and we moved ahead. But it might have been the fact that we didn't know any better was probably an advantage, you know, because if we figured that there were some limitations, you know, then we wouldn't have shot for the moon, right? If we were going to do the easy thing, or you know, the path of least resistance. But we didn't know any better, you know. We just knew that the land was all important, and we always knew that the federal government was going to push for a financial settlement. So we just kept plugging away, and under very, very great odds. Well, because we, don't you remember our discussion? Were you asleep when we discussed the Court of Claims? Well, you know, I explained to you the Court of Claims and the Indian Claims Commission. You know, this mechanism was the traditional way. That is, after the Indians lost the battles, or they got hemmed in, then they went to Congress and said, "May we sue you?" And the Congress would say, "I'll pass a resolution saying yes, you may." Then they'd go to the Court of Claims and spend umpteen years going after a settlement that only gave you a few cents an acre. And then you'd spend a lot of it on lawyers and on consultants trying to determine your area of use and occupancy. And then they set up the Indian Claims Commission, specifically designed for Indians. It's still there. It was formed in 1946, I think. They thought it would last for 5 years. Well, it's been here since how many years now? 36. Well, we knew that was the thrust that the federal government would. In fact, that was always that was during the entire span of time. We were trying to negotiate the settlement, trying to get the Congress to move. The threat was always there of throwing us into the courts. Well, in fact, a good many of our council would have liked to go that route. You know, but we always felt that those of us who were trying to lead the settlement, we always felt that if we ended up in the courts, that we would never get the land. And not only that, we didn't have any money to pay anybody. And what lawyer was going to take on, what, you know, competent lawyer would take on a case, you know, the magnitude of this one, you know, and stay in there, you know, for how many years, right? It was a huge undertaking. And, but, you know, we could describe this one point in which our, you know, somebody mentioned William Paul. We talked about him not too long ago, the old man. Well, he was one of the great leader of the Thinking Haida down south, and their first native legislator. He was a lawyer, and he always wanted to go to court. And he voted with the Alaskan Council, in effect, the non-native council, when we had this big crisis over Ramsey Clark and Arthur Goldberg. And when we wanted to hire a national council, it was a huge crisis, because our Alaskan council didn't want to let go. They wanted to be right there, sort of advising us which way to go and what to do. But we felt we needed somebody with some stature. And we had a major crisis over that subject. Anyway, what I'd like to do today is talk about the extent to which our people had changed by the time we started making some moves in the mid-60s. Because, you know, I get the feeling that a lot of younger people think that we had a hell of a lot of options, you know, about the nature of how the settlement should have ended up. And I think maybe it'll give you some idea of where we were, you know, at the time that we had to try to make the decisions. And between, we already have been through some of the changes that occurred, say, between 1870 and 1970. And when you think of it, that's not a heck of a long period of time, you know. And what I've tried to impress on you is the extent to which we've had to try to absorb all the change that have arrived on the scene here in a relatively short period of time. And there had been some major changes that have been brought about, as you know, as we talked about, you know, from the time of the early explorations and then the traders you know, along the coast, and those also the whalers, you know, who not only went after the whale but also traded along the coasts. And there was the salmon canneries began to control the salmon streams, you know, which affected the people's ability to survive. And we had the discovery of gold, you know, in the southeast, in the interior, in Nome. And you remember the drastic kind of a change, even though I haven't read a lot about that period, the Russian period just prior to the sale, but, you know, there was a complete change in the whole environment of the Westerners, right? I mean, like the Russians, they sort of lived with, they didn't elevate themselves that much above the people. They ate sort of much the same, pretty much the same foods. And, I mean, not to say that they weren't destructive earlier, but there wasn't a great difference. There was they kind of lived together. They were some subjugated people. But then, and then here comes the Wild West, you know. I mean, in Sitka, if you'll recall. And of course, there was institutions of schools and churches that had been continuing to work on the mines, right? I mean, all this was working on the economic system, in effect, having effect on our economic system and our ability to survive. And these, of course, were working on the head, right? Okay, and we're talking about a span of time here where the schools and churches, all these were sort of, you know, mechanisms of the government, in effect. I mean, the schools and the churches were working hand in glove. Sheldon Jackson you know, just decided to maximize his ability to Christianize the savages and educate them at the same time, because you had the church and the government going in tandem, so to speak. And of course, even reindeer was used as a, despite the fact that it was sort of a necessary food source, it was also used as a mechanism of civilization, so to speak. Teaching the Indian responsibility, sort of like trying to teach him to become a farmer, right? And so, when you look at the materials on the early beginnings of this, it was in part for food, but in great part for a changing of the Eskimo from a hunter and fisher to somebody responsible for a economic unit of activity. It was very tough. It was a very tough, when you read even to this very day, we've got almost 8,000 head of deer, and it's really tough to make herdsmen out of hunters and fishermen. Even today, and that's why they had to bring the Lapps in, who that was their way of life. Today we still have a problem in teaching hunters and fishermen to be husbandrymen, okay? Animal husbanders. And of course, another element was the breaking of the leadership of the elders and the, what you might call, the shaman or our priests, right? And there began to be changes in the 20s and the 30s, especially. As these schools started having an impact, on the younger children, the social control and the decisions about survival came out of the Kadagi, pretty much, in our part of the world. I don't know, by the elders. And the schools, of course, they taught everybody in English. They were mandated to teach in English. And they were also trying to teach the native young to be, in effect, they're preparing them to live in a white world. The problem is not unlike it's been recently, where the trades that they were teaching they weren't there, right? I mean, they just weren't there to be used in the villages. And not only that, if a non-native enterprise needed, some skilled typist or something, or, somebody familiar with mechanical gadgets, more than likely they'd not hire the Eskimo, because there was racial prejudice as well. So it didn't exactly work. And in many respects, that is out there. Now, a lot of these people that they did train, maybe they never came back, right? They stayed in the cities. Because in many respects, some of them wouldn't be accepted back. In the village, they were different, and those that did return, I assume, probably didn't felt that they knew more than the elders. They had exposure to the outside world, and perhaps didn't want to do what they say. Do what they said. So, the role of the role that these people played, which was very substantial, also began to dissipate. And also the traditional economic activity was
changing throughout that entire period. That is, you know, you didn't just hunt for survival in your family and in your community, but you hunted for trade, right? I mean, you know, they'd pay a lot of money for fur. And also there began to be working for wages way back then. In the interior, you know, people were moving to the river so they can chop wood for the steamers, right, during that period of time, because they were steaming up the Yukon. And there was a lot of activity, building things, schools, or barging, I don't know that there was that many people that worked in the gold mines, more than likely not that many. Because there were so many unemployed non-native miners. And a lot of people, I presume, worked in canneries, especially in Southeast. Worked in the mines. They weren't... time constraint and all that. And the boarding schools. They formed the boarding schools at White Mountain, Eklutna, and where else? Eventually Inchcombe, but that's relatively recent. But this was back in, like, oh, you know, 40, 50 years ago, where they sent children, and also because of disease, you know, like there was a epidemic in 1918 or so, just whole communities got wiped out, and there were lots of children without parents to take care of, so they ended up sending them to orphanages. That's where a lot of, like our parents, learned English, and you know, they got the rudiments of a white man's education in those places. And for many of them, it was a real change, because they sometimes weren't very well accepted when they went back to the village. Also, by that time, you had had the, you know, by the 1930s, late 30s, 36 on, you had the introduction of, that's, you know, how many years ago? That's 44 years ago. But during that time, you had the teachers sort of leading the charge, you know, because they were representatives of the government. They were doing a little bit of everything. But they began to assume the responsibility not only of teaching, but under the Indian Reorganization Act, they became community welfare workers and social workers. They did medical and dental exams and prescriptions. They supervised the village government and the American legal system, right? They worked with the village cooperatives and reindeer herds. They enforced the quarantines and construction and repair of school property, and I suppose they had the probably some role in the effort to promote reservations. That was a direct consequence of the Indian Reorganization Act. So when I talk about this, what I call the Great White Father Complex, you know, that some of our people function under, that is, that this inability to frame the question of
your community from your perspective, but, you know, waiting for somebody here who, you know, had been, who had been the law, so to speak. Yeah. So, all this was occurring at that, during that span of time. And in the meantime, of course, I'm not so sure that the First World War had much of an effect on our people. I don't, you know, I don't know if any, I don't know one Eskimo who fought in World War I. And there must have been some. Good question, whether anybody knew enough English and knew enough about the system to go to war.
My grandfather did.
He did? Well, I don't know about up north, because back in those days, we're still living in a pagan, heathen stage, you know. But in the 1940s, during the Second World War, now that was a major, a major period of exposure. And if you've read Muktuk Marston's book about the national, what they call the ATG, you know, he went out there and he organized it, you know, and he was a man who was willing to cut the red tape and try to get things done. And he is a man very much remembered for his creation of the Alaska Territorial Guard, which is now the Alaska National Guard. The first Scout Battalion was the one of them. And but this is one of the early first times that our people received some organizational training, and out of which a good much of our leadership eventually emerged, was through the National Guard, or what started out as the Alaska Territorial Guard, which Greening supported when he was governor, when he was appointed governor, and which Muktuk Marston organized. And the Guard is still, even to this very day, a leadership training ground, you know, for people out in the bush. It has taken them into gatherings where they learn about the outside world, in effect. And many of them, this was their first exposure to the States, you know, back in the 50s and early 60s, when they went to training programs in Fort Ord, California, and into Alabama or Georgia, somewhere down in there. So Lloyd Amakana, who's I think he's the finance officer for the North Slope Borough, was a guardsman for many, many years. John Schaefer, who's our president, was almost ready to retire from the Guard when we snared him out of the Guard. In fact, I think he was 20 years in, and he's only in his early 40s. Lots of people like that came through the Guard. And of course, at the same time, the war caused a great population shift. Beginning, right around 40 or so is when it was about even Steven, you know, between the native and non-native population. But after the war, of course, the urban population started to grow substantially. And in a way, the whole idea, starting back in the this whole process that basically the country was so good at was in effect. It was began to be a part of the mental framework of many of our people. This idea of assimilation, whatever that means, which is what America was trying to do with the Indians, but couldn't find a decent way to do it, right? Because they wouldn't concede. And so this whole idea, in effect, was beginning to beginning to work insofar as a good many of our people were concerned. We began to perceive of ourselves as Americans, right? As opposed to Indians or Eskimos with loyalties that were to their own people. I mean, the educational system that started, with Sheldon Jackson was doing its chores. And of course, on top of that, we had had no war, so to speak. You know that forced the coalescing. That is, there had it was like a creeping absorption. So to speak, that was taking place, and the native people didn't unlike the Indians, they didn't take up arms,
except in those early days down there with the Russians. Well, when you look at it, the native people were, during all this time, so decimated by disease, by the effects of the resource exploitation that was taking place over here, and by pressures from missionaries, traders, government officials, and the very fact that life was so tough, particularly in the interior and the Arctic. That, it was probably easier to accept the idea that your survival was pretty much maybe better insured if you kind of went along with this process. And consequently, at the time that we started trying to deal with this settlement, on a sort of a day-to-day basis, things that happened before that, but on a kind of a sporadic basis and not on a statewide basis, was a little bit here and a little bit there. There had been a substantial amount of effect of all this on our people. There had been some urbanization as well. With people moving into the Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau and Ketchikan and those places. So that was sort of where we were when we had to start getting down to the nitty gritty with the federal government. Or were you just stretching?
You said that before, when first started, there was no money. Well, how did that change? And who started funding you guys?
Okay. I'll tell you what. Let me tell you, the first time I ever made a trip, strictly for the purpose of talking to somebody about land, when I left Kosovo, that is after I borrowed the $55 to get back, was paid by the tyrant. Kayunik Indians. They're a little group, a few miles from Anchorage. And that poor little village, of course, it was not unlike lots of other villages, just having all kinds of problems. I mean, flying in and out of Anchorage, and, it was just like having all kinds of troubles. And all of a sudden, they ended up with, I think, $12 to $14 million because they lived on a reserve. The Tyonet Reserve, it was created by the Secretary of Interior, I think, way back when, as a school reserve or something, for the benefit of these people. And probably hardly anybody understood the extent to which they had any rights, in relation to the reserve. But Stanley McCutcheon used to hunt over there and hunt ducks or something. He knew those people, and he convinced the federal government, Secretary Udall, to give him that money that was secured from a lease, oil and gas lease sale. So when the Public Land Law Review Commission which was something that Congressman Aspinall created when he was chairman of the House Interior Committee. They had hearings, and the Tyonics asked me to come down there to give the native position, right? And things were so bad in terms of information. I didn't have any maps. I just had kind of like a little map about Sophie, you know, with the map of Alaska, and I had kind of inked in all the different claims that had been made to date, ours and the slopes and a few others. And here these people were operating under the assumption that they were not going to deal with native claims. This is in mid-summer of 1966. What eventually emerged as the sort of public land management act. I forget what the correct title is, but this was the origin of that, where they were reviewing all of the public land laws dealing with leasing and grazing and mining and all that, emerged out of that. And so what I did was I followed these people from Anchorage to Fairbanks to Kotzebue and said the same thing at every place, that is, you cannot deal with public land in Alaska unless you dealt with the native claims. And that was where I got my first ticket, right, was through the Tyonics. And then when we formed AFN in 1966, they also bankrolled a good many of the participants, you know, bought tickets. They committed themselves to helping get that first AFN meeting off the ground. And also, we borrowed not only $100,000 from the Tyonics, I think we borrowed, $225,000 from the Yakimas, Yakima Indians.
That was borrowed?
Huh?
It was borrowed.
Yeah. And then we borrowed another, I think it was $125,000 or so. I don't know the exact figures from the Alaska, let's see, from the NBA, National Bank of Alaska, but this was guaranteed by the Clickett and Haida Central Council. And these are the debts that I had to deal with after I assumed the presidency after Don Wright. This was after the Settlement Act. But we had not only this debt, but we had a total of about $750,000 debt that we had to deal with when I took the presidency of the AFN. And then at the same time, we also got government programs, see, at the AFN to help defray some of the costs of administration and also some of the salaries of some of our leadership. And also, the Ford Foundation came through with some money, which eventually turned into what's called the Alaska Native Foundation. the Association on American Indian Affairs, AIA. They didn't come up with any monies like this. But they did provide support and they set people up, and they helped us get to the Ford Foundation.
I don't know if you noticed, but the first $800 were given to Panama Chiefs was by them.
Is that right?
Uh-huh.
They never had that much money, but they were very supportive of, in terms of contact, you know, people influential in the media. They had people on their board from the New York Times. So from that standpoint, they were very helpful from an information standpoint as well. A lot of my early information I got through AAIA. Of course.
Did you think actually speak from them, or?
Well, I don't know. They might be willing to come up.
Would that be interesting?
The guy who was there then and still is there now, I think, is Bill Violet. And you see, at one time in Indian history, most of the policy, Indian policy, was made in the East, right? By people with, you know, who had influential contact in the government. This is before the Indians really got developed to the point where they began to influence their own programs, right? The Association of American Indian Affairs, the Indian Rights Association in Philadelphia was another one. And these were people, these were old organizations that were created by people who wanted to help the Indians. But in reality, in many instances, they created a lot of policy until the Indians developed enough confidence to and leadership to sort of pressure the government themselves. I got to get some water. Let's take a break. Okay, one of the other things we had to deal with was that, you know, Congress just wasn't dealing with one group, you know, like the Navajo or the Hopi or, you know, it was a whole conglomeration of groups, and we, no matter how much we wanted to try to make a settlement that would fit our particular group, it was an impossibility. Because when Congress dealt with the problem, it was dealt with on the basis of a whole. So the different ways of each group didn't really have a great deal of relevance. The different land uses and the different cultural activities didn't make any difference to Congress. They looked at us as one huge problem. We had, despite the fact that we had, you know, five or six different groups, but so fun. One big pain. Also, even if we wanted to, you know, we were inhibited by distance and personality. And by time. Time and space, I guess you call it. Because you know, we might have ended up, say, with one region between the Arctic Slope, Nana, and Bering Straits. You know, it was possible because of our linguistic, you know, grouping, right? But the doggone airlines didn't go in the right directions, you know? And also, we had different personalities that, as time went on, everybody had their own thing going. Like, Ituk and his bunch were doing their thing, and I guess they assumed that I was going to take care of my area. And so they got a little head start, and I came along a few months later, 6 months later, to our group, and then, you know, 5 years later, Bering Straits got organized. And, you know, so we had, we might have ended up with a different arrangement. For instance, if we had had a little bit more time and money, say, to meet, just to talk about it, right? But everybody was sort of doing their own thing.
Do you feel if you really had more time and more money and did things the way you wanted to have them done or the way you felt they really should have been done at that time, that it would have been possible to have a more favorable settlement than the settlement that was given? It seems like that could have been negative to your cause by having more of those things going for you.
Well, it's hard to say. I guess It's hard to say what would have happened if we had more time and more money, you know, because I can see, you know, what's happening in Canada, right? The government is funding those groups, and they've been planning and negotiating for years. They haven't gone anywhere. Okay. Of course, their system is a little different, but we might have been reduced to doing just that, you know, if we had had more money and more time. And maybe we might have had more internal problems, I don't know. You know, the fact is that we all felt a sense of urgency that, you know, at any point in time, we always thought perhaps number one, they'd throw us into the courts. Number two, they'd get a kind of an executive order by the president that would have, say, granted the pipeline right away. Right? There was a great deal of insecurity, and in many respects, we never quite knew how far to push it. You know, because if the country got so teed off at us for taking too much time, the threat, you know, on more than one occasion was the, you know, some senators who were just kind of tired of our issue because they had all these huge, you know, Vietnam going and presidential elections going and other, you know, the National Environmental Protection Act, you know, I mean, all kinds of huge, you know, ours was just, you know, just a little problem they could have swept under the rug quite easily, perhaps. You know, you know, we always thought perhaps maybe the president or somebody, the oil companies would get to the president and say, hey, man, national security requires us to have that pipeline. And, you know, with a stroke of the pen, shoop, there would have been our complete deal. You know, we never knew for sure. So, in a way, even though we had all these problems, political problems internally, as well as political problems in the outside world, you know, when you read Mary Berry's book, you'll see what the hell we had to contend with. When it really came down to it, we always could agree that, by God, if we didn't get this settlement, we may never get it, right? We may never have the kind of opportunity to get it resolved that we had then. So when somebody was peeling off because they were teed off, you know, Cecil Barnes, the Chugach region, or Charlie and Joe and them would fly off there. We had problems over here with Chalice, or the ABCP wanted to go their way. You know, I mean, we had all kinds of, it was a centrifugal type of problem, you know. We had nothing drawing us together but this necessity of having to work together to get the settlement. So when it came down to the nitty-gritty, we were generally together. And of course, we were living this thing from morning till night, 7 days a week. You know, I mean, you could get quite a story on the number of families that dissipated, you know, because everybody was so busily engaged in this thing. And this settlement came, you know, whether or not we were ready for it, I don't know whether we would have ever been really ready. Because in a way, we were trying to deal in a situation where America had been unable to deal with it, really. When you look at it in the context of history, America had never been able to come up with any means of resolving Indian disputes that didn't necessitate some sort of a reservation, you know, or virtually the taking of that entire land base of that group. Right? I mean, in all of the lower 48, the only land they got left amounts to about 50 million acres. And 16 of that is in the Navajos, you know, thereabouts. So, you see the kind of odds we were dealing with. And here we're trying to come up with something that would sort of meet the country's historical necessity, so to speak, of trying to figure out a way to deal with a people that were already there. They had their own identity, their own languages, and their own way. You know, without, in the minds of some of those senators and congressmen, sort of going back in time, you know, to this old tribal structure that, from their standpoint, had never worked. And in a way, we tried to maximize that, you know, our position in that respect. That is, in order to get the amount of land that we thought we should have, you know, we sort of had to make some concessions as well. And because we were dealing in a highly political atmosphere. I mean, in some respects, we were just an interest group like other interest groups, you know, like labor or environmentalists, the oil industry, except, you know, in a way, we were challenging the country's history. We were saying, my God, once and for all, try to do something right, you know, or at least, you know, don't just run over us. And at the time that we were, excuse me.
Weren't they curious about what you said? And I thought the big issue was that they were afraid that they were going to carve a piece of land out for you guys, and you weren't going to get as good a land as if you picked it yourselves.
Oh, yeah.
Of
course, we wanted as much flexibility in land selection as possible. We wanted flexibility. But in reality, the way they saw it, they didn't really want us to have that kind of flexibility. The state didn't want us to have that flexibility. And neither did the environmentalists, for that matter. And when you really come down to it, we didn't have anybody in that room who was really with us. You know, when it came down to the conference committee, you know, between the House and the Senate, I mean, the three people we had there, you know, the two senators and the congressman, they weren't ours. They were theirs, you know. And they were there to protect the state. I mean, the final negotiations in the Settlement Act, we were not really in. In effect, we were never really in, except as an outsider, you know, trying to work the system. And so, see, the cards were pretty much stacked against us ever coming out with everything we wanted. But in reality, I think from where we started, you know, we got a lot more out of the system than I think anybody had ever hoped. Of course, we had visions of grandeur. You know, like in my region, I always thought, hell, we were going to have all this land, about 30 million acres, and the country was going to let us live out our lives, you know, in our own way, and sort of develop however best we could without too much outside pressure, right? That's what we had hoped, but of course life isn't perfect, you know. At the time that we were working on the settlement,
of course, the country was all wrapped up in not only civil rights but in the Vietnam War, and we were sort of like the final product of the winning of the West, whatever that might mean, depending on which side of it you were on, and. And we were trying to, in effect, we were trying to remind the country of the ferocity by which they had taken, you know, the Indians
75 years or 80 years before. So that we had that whole span of time, which Alaska was sort of a forgotten place, really. And they had mopped up the winning of the West, and here we came along with another big Indian land problem. And they were disenchanted with the Indian way, that is the tribal system, the tribal government system. And in reality, like we talked about before, we were kind of fighting the tide, that assimilationist tide, that, you know, our country really has been a master at taking people from all over the world and reforming them into an American. And Senator Jackson and others simply did not feel that the creation of racial enclaves, as they call them, these new tribal entities with trust land, simply wasn't in his consciousness to create. And also, as we can see by our discussion earlier, I mean, our people had changed so much, whether or not that would have been the way to, you know, settle it is kind of an open question. Whether that, you know, we may have had more problems, I don't know, if we created that system, you know, than this other way. Because you can see the problems we're having right now just over hunting and fishing issues. I mean, if we had a distinct tribal government, you know, could I really be standing here saying I'm a full-fledged Alaska? Right? You'd say, no, you're not. You belong to those guys up there. Well, you see, we may have, you know, created a vehicle that was probably maybe the best vehicle insofar as accommodating each other is concerned in Alaska. Because in reality, what the message I've been trying to give to our people is that, you know, in order to be an Eskimo or Indian, you don't have to be blessed by the government to be. That's a matter of your own identification and your own desire to be. But that doesn't prevent you from doing lots of other things. As you know, in the 50s they had a terminationist period where the Congress was doing everything possible to terminate the Indians. That is, the government was trying to say, all right, I got it, you're like the rest of us. You know, forget about those treaties. Here's your walking paper, so to speak. You're a full-fledged American. And they had, terminated a couple of tribes. This had lots of timber, I guess, and the Menominees supposedly had timber, but it failed, and they eventually went back under the federal wing again. They became Indians again. It took them many years to convince the government that they were euchred into this deal, that the timber on their land was not adequate to support this lumber mill, and everything just went to hell. So they spent years attempting to come back to be Indians again. But so you see, if we were going to do something other than what occurred, it was an uphill battle to do it, is what I'm trying to say. Well, I don't know what middle ground we could have created. We had nothing to guide us on that score. In this instance, the assimilationist tendencies of the Congress showed in a variety of ways. In effect, the tribe became a corporation. The enrollees to the tribe were basically enrollees to the corporation. The land that normally went to a tribal council for
to manage, you know, ended up as a part of the corporation. And there was no government function whatsoever. No government function on the part of the corporation.
Which, with a tribe, that was their function, was to govern, in effect. Manage your land and carry on the tribe.
Get that down. And these were state-chartered corporations as well.
They weren't, they were federally mandated, but
chartered by the state as ordinary business corporations. And like we've talked about before, the governmental responsibilities didn't go with the corporation, they went with the municipal government, again organized under the state. The land was not held in trust by the federal government. It's basically held sort of in trust by the corporation. That is, it's corporate land holdings that they are to protect and enhance. There was limited protection for the stock.
An old trick, you know, that they used back in the Dawes Act days. Keep the land for 20 years and then sell it for a bottle of booze.
Well, stock is not alienable until 1992. And of course, like we mentioned earlier, there's no role for the BIA either. So in all those ways,
reflects the desire of Congress to end the old way, in effect, in dealing with Indians. And it also reflected our own tendencies to not want to try to fit our people into an old mold. You know,
so the settlement reflected in a way all the changes that had taken place among ourselves as a result of a couple hundred years or more of contact with both the Russians and Americans. All of our social institutions had changed from the old days, the marriage and divorce, even adoptions. The economic life had changed. There was more work. There were taxes. Some people were in business. Religions had changed, language had changed, concepts of justice had changed, cannibalism and slavery was, I assume, changed, and diet and housing had changed, and the form of governing had changed. So nothing was the same as it had been at the turn of the century. And we were placed in a position of having to decide whether we wanted to revert to what was called a kind of a wardship status, that is, of having the government as our trustee, sort of an assumption of our being like children. You know, this is the way that the missionaries described us back then. You know, we were to be led by the hand like children, so to speak. And in reality, when some of us who had known a little bit of the history, we understood that even this trusteeship and this whole wardship arrangement had not really worked either, because despite the Bureau of Indian Affairs and responsibilities of the trustee, they still had been taken to the cleaner, so to speak. They had still lost a good many of their resources. They had still lost their oil and gas, you know, or their coal, or their minerals, or their water was inundated by dams, by the Corps of Engineers, you know, with the
the active connivance of the Indian agents, because the Indians didn't have any power. And there was a great, I think, intense desire on the part of our leadership to try to have as much to say about our own futures as possible. Because in those days, we didn't have anything to say about anything. I mean, you know, from the, you know, in those days, we didn't even have any school responsibilities, right? It was all the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We couldn't tell the superintendent or the principal to do anything, let alone how the public health service ran their hospitals and their policies. I mean, we were just at the absolute lowest end of the political spectrum. So I'm not sure at that stage what the result might have been if say our parents were in control. Some of us who were quite young. You know, Charlie was, you know, we were all in our 20s. I think Emo was old, he was maybe in his early 30s. We had the oldest person I was engaged with, I think, was Degnan, Frank Degnan from Needle Street. You know, Tetzler, he was a little older, but sort of the same generation. At least he could stay up all night and party like the rest of us. Who else was there? Dogs. You know, he was his late 30s, early 40s. You know, I mean, we didn't have that many old people, but what the consequence might have been if the older structure had been, you know, had been in power. Would we have gotten a settlement? And if so, what would have been the nature of the settlement that they might have agreed to? Let me tell you the pressures that were on us. What I could have seen, for one thing, they would have been more subject to, I think, traditional authority, which in effect would have been the system. Right? It would have been the Bureau of Indian Affairs. They would have been, I think, more subject to control by attorneys. That was always the major problem we had, was trying to maintain control of our own institutions, our own organization. From almost the very time we created AFN, there was a tendency to take that from us as well. Because, for one thing, the Bureau always questioned whether or not we understood what we were doing.